Ah.
Having none, his motion to approve the market was sudden.
You want to judge first four meetings where you make a motion to consider the names just to kind of help her out?
Any discussion? I think I'm going to have a chance to do this. All in favor?
Aye.
I have a motion to approve the August 25th.
That's Cynthia?
Yeah.
Arden,
the second. Arden, any questions or discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Very much. Next item is approve the same budget. Meetings. Now it's time to find that. Find it.
I lost you.
I'll stay in.
So the president didn't appear. We had some adjustments. Didn't keep the agency grants, and I guess the agency grants. So it's basically a moving target going into the new year. But I'm presenting you with a budget for a total of $3,785. Based on the grants that we're using, they did a brown panel in the year. So there's a federal revenue coming into the organization in the next fiscal year.
No, the whole theater is of a lesson.
That's about
40%. Any questions? I'm motion to approve the plan. Any motion to date? No, it's not.
Do you need to have 5 seconds?
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any dissent? Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the board of directors for passing the FY26 budget. As Judy indicated, it's been very challenging the last few years since the pandemic, actually. Lots of new money coming in. Now we're looking at going forward where there's a lot of uncertainty around the budgets. So it's certainly a lot of awesome. Judy's done an outstanding job of that. So those are kind of the budget of law to train bucks in our long-time business combined and particularly.
Yeah.
That said, I would like to let the board of directors and everyone know that this is Judy's final budget for the organization. She's retiring at the end of June after 33 years with the LED. She may notice in the audience that a few past presidents here and all the staff spoke a few honored. Thank you for coming. When I began with NVDA, John Hall, who just replaced Charlie Carter many years ago. And then later on, Steve Patterson, never in the most wanted to be the Judy when I wanted to answer about anything related to grants, the organization or the budget, and they were absolutely correct. Judy's been a cornerstone of the UBDA organization and someone I have deeply trusted and relied on for all my years as director. And I'm confident saying that I, on all the staff, was really miss her presence while wishing her the best in front of the country. So that said, we would like to thank Judy with a gift and honor for a long time service for the UBDA. This way she can remember her time with us. Maybe the outstanding professional service for NBDA in 1992-2025.
I've worked under the greatest executive directors, Charlie Carter, Donna Hall, Steve Patterson, and Dave Snedden. Yeah. And even though I was born and raised in some of the southern towns of Caledonia County, it has been an enjoyment of mine to see the whole Northeast Kingdom, the towns in Orleans and Essex, as well as the Northern part of the county. So yeah, I feel very privileged to have had the opportunity to work with. Thank you.
April 30th at a hearing in the town office to take comment on the Canadian town plan. And we made a motion to grant like the approval for the board. So at this point, I would make a motion for the board to agree with the Canadian town plan. We had a hearing to the town college. A comment on the approval of the recently adopted policy. And we also recommend on that third. So at this point, I would take a motion to approve the policy.
So moved, David.
Okay, so we have a first and a second.
Yeah.
All in favor of moving the policy town plan, please signify by saying no.
Allison, I'm sorry. Can I get those names one more time?
I'm sorry?
Could I get the names one more time? First?
Yeah, Paul made the motion and then seconded. Finally, we have Walden, and this is our first ever council. And yes, the hearing was on May 12th. And we have attended this first schedule. Recently adopted the first ever. So at this point, I would propose to involve Will, go for another
session. Sure.
Okay, so we have a first text all in favor. Well, that is first ever adopted. It's aye. All opposed. And now we have to open the church. But this is to confirm everyone's efforts. It only takes about 4 hours. So, the purpose of this hearing is to confirm those planning efforts of the pre council and approved on plans. That would be Mabel on in Walden. So, this also enables them to provide broader benefits from the the ACE of CTE by being a confirming community. So, would somebody make a motion to confirm those top planning efforts? Paul, going for it before. Second?
Yes.
Cynthia, thank you. So, all in favor of confirming the planning efforts of Canaan, Holland, and Baldwin? Please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed. So now we can just make a motion to close the hearing. We just need one vote.
So moved.
Thank you. We're done. Thank you.
I think that's a record, Allison. Next item is changes to the bylaws, the amendments. They want to come on up. So as the open meeting law changed, we discovered that NDEA would never be able to go on things out of business because you required it for the amount of entities we had to get. So they've spent looking at another set of bylaws that they got for us, and that resulted as it transfers the operational responsibility for NDEA to the executive committee, whatever changes and things responsibility. So I don't know if we've had a chance to review my vote we have a great questions. Any questions?
No, I mean, it's exactly in the office. It makes sense. You're a method of operation to make us fly at the
meeting. So, I have a question then to adopt the agenda bylaws.
So,
yeah.
So, are we done with that?
Yep.
Next item is a school officer's standing workers' compensation plan. We do this annually because really the officers, the cost of the workers' compensation would be very high.
No.
Yes. We're highly compensated. I got one of the low cancer diet programs. So we have a motion to exclude the officers from the workers' compensation. Any discussion? All in favor? Thank you very much.
I'll take the next item with the agenda because Fred's part of that. So we need to elect the at-large board members representing citizen interest groups. The current members are Tom Robinson representing banking, but he's outgoing and indicated he does not wish to continue on. And then Fred Saar representing the nonprofit sector. Unless somebody's stuck on a holiday and thinks they can represent banking, we'll leave that vacant for now. And then we just need to elect Fred as a nonprofit sector representative.
No, we elect Fred.
Gina, is there a second?
Second,
Jim Davis. And all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Now, let's see.
So, thanks, speakers. All right, Blake Rennie, I'd like to go ahead and introduce our guest speaker, Charlie Narduzzi. So Charlie is a regional Emmy Award-winning, nationally recognized garden writer, speaker, radio, and television personality. He's worked for more than 35 years bringing expert gardening information to home gardeners through radio, TV, talk tours, online, and the printed page. He's authored 7 garden books. I think some of them may be here. Has 2 radio shows in Vermont and a TV segment on WCNS. Does talks around the country and leads garden tours to the UK and Europe. So being June in the Northeast Kingdom, I thought it would be a great time to have Charlie come and speak to our group. So thanks, Charlie.
I'm going to wake up my computer and then we can start. Okay. Great. So thank you all for having me come up here. I haven't been here for a while, so it was fun driving up here. And it's like, hey, you don't have thunderstorms again. I kept hitting them driving up from Edison County. I get here, sunshine, rainbows. And so what I want to talk about today, and feel free to eat as the talk fine. I'll go on for, 3 hours? I want to talk about ecological gardening. But before I do that, how many people are gardeners? One shape. Well, ecological gardening is one of those things on that new trend in gardening. And what I'm going to talk about is how it applies to so many different aspects of your garden. So vegetable gardening, soil building, taking care of perennial flowers, horticultural practices doing that, growing more native plants that help pollinators and wildlife, and one that's probably getting most of your interest, invasive plants, and how to take care of those. Anyone have any invasive plants? So let's start talking about ecological gardening. If you hang out in a career long enough, I've been doing this for almost 40 years now, you get to see trends. And so it all started for me back when, let's try it again. There he is. All right, so guess who that is?
Isn't he the cutest thing in the world?
And he has hair, too. That's me in my mother's garden way back when, many years ago, in Connecticut, where I grew up. And my mother was one of 5 or 6 siblings, and every time one of them got married, my grandfather and grandmother had a farm. They gave them a piece of land on the farm. So I grew up with all my siblings on the same row. My aunt, my uncles, my cousins, I thought the whole world lived like that. But he was not working there, like, people don't do that. But anyway, each one of them grew up with a farm. They were the only one to have their own garden. And so every spring, my grandfather would come up with the old farm, old tractors, and he would till that soil, turn it all over again, and he would pick the rocks. My brother just picked the rocks up. My mother would come in with her transplants and her seeds and with her 10-10-10 fertilizer and her sprays that kill all the bugs and all of that kind of stuff. And that's just kind of how I thought gardening happened until I came up to Vermont, went to the University of Vermont, got a degree in plant and soil science. And by then, organic gardening got to be very popular. And so it was a great move in a different direction where we're using more safer product into the soil, compost and compost of indoors, and not using so many harmful chemicals. But still, the mentality was kind of the same as you go along with them. And what happened, Up there, you go there. When you look at just organic practices, it's a step in the right direction, but it's still just looking at the garden. I used to do garden coaching. Now I would go to someone's yard and they'd have a vegetable garden and they would pride themselves in saying that they're an organic gardener with any chemicals or things in that vegetable garden. But then you look in their shed or their garage and you see the 2,4-D for the lawns and you see these pesticides for the trees and the shrubs and all these other things. So it's still just looking at the individual garden. It's still talking about individual inputs and outputs. You put in this organic fertilizer, you just get this kind of plant that grows out from it. Still kind of have that input-output idea behind it. And it values the soil, but only to a certain extent. We're building organic matter, but we're still turning and tilling and working soil every year. And it doesn't actively incorporate the rest of the landscape. What's happening on the, in the hedges, the trees, the shrubs, the lawns, the flower gardens, all those other things. The ecological garden, from a different viewpoint, is kind of the new wave that's been happening, is that it looks at the total yard, the total environment, not just your yard, even like your neighbors, a community or a region of areas. It protects and it builds on your soil fertility. So the whole idea that I grew up with and I was taught actually in university was that the soil is like an empty vessel. You have to add all these nutrients, minerals, and into that soil in order to get plants to grow. Scientists take all those things out. But what happens when you take a look at nature, you realize that no one's out there cultivating the trees and the forests and the grasslands. Where I live behind our house, there's a ledge. And on that ledge, there are these huge oak trees and shagbark hickory trees. They've been there, they're 50 feet tall. They're growing on that ledge. No one planted them there. No one fertilizes them. No one takes care of them. And yet they're really healthy plants that are growing there. So it kind of tells you there's something else going on that's beyond this whole old mentality of you have to add a lot of things to the soil to get things to grow. And what it is, and I'll talk about it in a minute, it's all about the soil, how the soil supports the growth of all the plants. So we want to mimic those and enhance those natural systems when we're growing our own gardens. In the process of doing all this, it's going to reduce the amount of labor and time you have to spend on the garden because nature is doing all of it. And use local resources. By using local resources, you'll be able to have soils and composts that are compatible with the soil that you're growing things. So a typical organic garden, this is an old one from one of my older houses, is this kind of thing. Everything planted in rows, everything grouped together, that kind of thing. You know, everything segregated out. You know, flowers here, vegetables there, herbs there, that kind of thing. An ecological yard will look a little bit more like Dave's yard. That's the Dave's yard. That's the yard.
Yeah, that's
fine. He wasn't expecting. This is a yard out in Hampshire, California. A friend of mine, Roz Creasy's yard, and this is literally less than a quarter of an acre per yard. But every year in the spring, she replants everything there, and you can see that she integrates all kinds of different plants in that yard. Now, I know most of you are gardeners, so you can identify those plants. But if you weren't gardeners, and you just looked at it from an artistic viewpoint, what you can see is that you have a lot of different plants that are really attractive, like this tall plant that looks like a grass plant with the long leaves and the tassels on top, the nice vine growing up here with heart-shaped leaves, this little plant here that looks like a Christmas tree and a painter, then one over here that looks like a tropical plant. So if you didn't know anything about plants, you can appreciate them for the these textures and sizes, and of course, these are sweet corn, whole beans, rosemary, and summer squash. And so she would tuck in vegetables and plants in there. So somewhere in there, there's a bell pepper. Can you find a bell pepper? So she would integrate all these plants in there. So the landscape looks beautiful and it has an ecological balance to it because it has a diversity of plants. Now, you might not do that kind of garden, but the mentality behind it really should be something that you look at when you look at the garden. But all of this starts with the soil. If I was going to start my career all over again, I would definitely become a soil scientist because there's amazing things that are happening in the soil science world right now. That whole idea of the empty vessel that's your soil really been debunked now because they found that by looking at the soil under microscopes, that there's lots of microbes. Actually, there's a scientist out in Oregon. Here we go. Named Elaine Ingham. who we started studying this, and she found that there's over 4 billion microbes in a teaspoon of soil. It's healthy soil. 4 billion microbes, bacteria, fungi, viruses, protozoa, all kinds of things. And what they're doing is creating networks that help transfer water and nutrients around in the soil to the different plants that are in the soil. So when we talk about mimicking nature, nature is doing it this way, we want to do the same thing. Now, what happens in nature is that forest, especially in an older growth forest, doesn't get disturbed. And so that soil has a chance to create these networks that become strong networks that really feed the plants. What we do a lot of times in our garden, though, is that we're turning soil. We're tilling the soil every day. We're creating the soil. We're cultivating the soil. soil in the ground. And so every time we do that, we break up the networks. When you break up the networks, they have to be formed again, and it kind of slows down the soil building process. So what we're talking about with building soil is really mimicking what happens in nature. Over here. First, we want to preserve the soil. By preserving the soil, what it means is that you want to make sure that the soil doesn't erode out, that the soil doesn't get stripped by winds and rains and from hail and seed and all kinds of things. So you always want to have some organic material on the soil, whether it be a plant that's growing there or organic material. And then on top of that, you want to build that soil fertility. The way you're going to build it is mimicking what happens in nature. So you go into a deciduous forest, in fall, of course, all the leaves drop down. If you look at that forest floor, it's always got something covered in it, whether it be leaves on it, whether it be plants on it, it has something there. You rarely see bare soil. And that's going to protect those soil microbes that are in that soil. So we want to actually mimic that at the same time. And how we do it is with no-dig gardening. So no-dig gardening is similar to no-till farming, similar to lasagna gardening. And it's a technique that's been around for many years, and it's kind of come back into favor. Because what it does is it preserves those soil microbes and those networks that have been created so that you can have a healthier garden with a lot less work. And how you can build these, you can simply just get some compost, mix it with topsoil, and build your beds. And that's a simple way to do it. But if you have a lot of land, you probably don't want to spend all that money to bring in soil. So you can create layers. It's also called lasagna garden. For the same reason. So a basic way to do this is an illustration for my book, which, by the way, is for sale. Right? Oh, I forgot to mention that. So what you do is, if you're going to start a new no-dig bed, you want to mow down the area that it is, whether it be on a lawn or if it's a weedy area, mow it all down. And then the bottom layer is going to be some material that's going to block any of that organic or those grasses or leaves from growing again. So in this case, if it says grass, you can put 4 layers of newsprint down, and it can be colored newsprint. That's okay, as long as it's not glossy newsprint. Glossy newsprint has chemicals in it. You don't want to have really soil. And then on top of that, you just put layers. So maybe some chopped up hay or straw, maybe some of the grass clippings from an untreated lawn, maybe some chopped up leaves from the fall, maybe even some food scraps from your kitchen. Chop them all up. You do this in the fall, you put a compost layer on top of it to hold it all together. And it only has to be 3 to 4 inches thick. If you walk out of here today and decide, I'm going to do a no-dig bed, you can do the same process, but you're going to have 6 to 8 inches of compost on top, because obviously nothing has a chance to break out of it. Well, what we're doing is mimicking, just like every year the leaves fall down onto the forest floor and build up slowly that compost. We're just accelerating it by putting many layers together. And what ends up happening is that you have this rich soil that holds water better, doesn't have any weeds in it because it's capped off with compost. So even if you use hay as one of the layers that has wheat seeds in it, it's still, those seeds are buried, so it never will grow up really well. It's very fertile soil, so regardless of what your base soil is, clay, sandy soil, rocky soil, you're building healthy soil on top of it. And it's really easy to maintain. It's going to be the same thing every year, putting an organic layer and a compost on top of that. So, my book, I saw it. It popped up, sorry, I don't know how it got in there. So when you're using compost to put it on top of these layers, you have to be clear about what kind of compost you want to use. First of all, you want to get local compost. The reason is not just you're supporting local farmers and compost producers, it's also because of the microbial profile that's in it.
Because if you go to a garden center or a home center and buy bags of compost from who knows where, they might be coming from California, Iowa, Florida, Texas, who knows where, right? And the compost that's in there has a microbial profile from where that was produced. You bring it to Vermont and put it in the soils here, it may not be as compatible with the microbes you already have. So get local resources using local materials to create your compost. The compost you get, it's always nice if you can go out and actually touch and feel and smell the compost. Yes, put your nose into the compost. It should smell earthy. It shouldn't smell sour at all. You can even taste it. No, don't. It should have a nice brown color to it, and it should have some of the material still in it that it was used to make that compost. It shouldn't be like dusty kind of thing that blows away. So getting good quality compost is important. Now, what are the advantages of this no-dig system? Well, the soil winds for a change. And so you probably have seen these microbes or mycorrhizae in the soil that can go through a forested area or a meadow area that hasn't been disturbed. This stuff around you sometimes see that white hyphae going around. That's a type of mycorrhizae. Mycorrhizae is a fungus that creates these networks that goes on for miles all over the place, creating this. And not only does it transfer water and nutrients, it does one other thing that makes it even more fascinating. And that's what it does, is that it communicates. It helps plants communicate with each other. This is where it gets a little woo-woo with science. So what happens is that scientists have found that you have a healthy tree in a forest, and if there's a young tree next to it or an unhealthy tree next to it, that healthy tree will transport nutrients and water to the young or the unhealthy trees, because the tree obviously knows that more important for the forest than one tree to really survive. So there's even life lessons there in the garden, right? So there's movement of nutrients based on what's going on in the forest. The other thing that's really cool is that if an insect attacks the edge of the forest, in the oak trees in the forest, and it's a gypsy moth, that tree that gets attacked sends out a pheromone out through the atmosphere that all the other tree leaves can absorb. And what it tells them is we produce chemicals that the gypsy moth wouldn't like to eat. So it's an intelligence out in the forest as you're walking around, and the forest is watching you. So watch what you do and say. So another thing about how the soil wins is that it helps the plant. It helps the plant in the sense that the old thinking of how nutrients work with soil and plants is that there's nutrients in the soil and the plants take them up. It's a one-way street. It was one direction. Now soil scientists are finding that it's not one way. It's two ways. In fact, plants will actually produce more food than they need, and they will actually release it into the soil to feed the microbes. 20 to 40% of the food they make, they will spend into the soil to feed the microbes. And what that's going to be doing is creating a healthy soil and a healthy plant. So one of the best tenets of ecological gardening that you follow is always have something growing on your soil, whatever it is, your lawn, your garden, whatever it is. Don't leave bare soil around, because that's the death knell for that soil. You want to have some, even if it's weeds, it's better than nothing. You can have something growing on that soil. And in that process, also, some of the carbon from photosynthesis is taken out of the atmosphere, gets released by the roots into the soil, and it gets sequestered there. By getting sequestered there, what ends up happening is that you're reducing the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and reducing the effects of global warming. So there's lots of different ways that this is working in our benefit. It's less setup and less maintenance for you, and you'll have a healthier soil and healthier plants. So once you've got your beds built, then there's some things you can do that are kind of in the same venue as ecological gardening. One is companion planting. Anyone ever do companion planting? Planting certain things next to each other in the garden? Yeah. So one way to look at it is just using how plants grow to maximize the benefit of having them grow together. We don't have to create long farms of acreage of different plants here. We can just grow them in beds and mix and match what's in there. You can interplant things. So this is a shot from our garden. These are, of course, peas here. And then there's our lettuces. So that whole idea behind the legumes is that they fix nitrogen from the atmosphere into a chemical that the other plants can use. Usually the thought was that you have to cut down that plant and till it under that legume in order for it to actually be usable for the other plants. But in this case, they've now found that it happens as the plants are growing. So I always have leafy greens next to my legume, peas, things of that nature.
It could be lettuce, it could be arugula, spinach, Swiss chard, whatever you want. Mixing and matching the plants that way. You can do with beans here. These are beans down here on either side of a row of kale. They're feeding the kale. So you get two or three crops from that one bed without doing anything. Just having a healthy soil and planting the right plants together. Also, with companion planting, it can provide insect controls. What's the flower that everyone grows to repel insects?
Marigold.
That's right. And they don't. But scientists have been working on this. They actually are fascinated with finding companion planting, and they have found some results at different land-grant universities, California, Iowa, other places, that do work. And one of them that works is nasturtiums with zucchini. You get squash bugs. Anyone here have squash bugs on their zucchini, summer squash, all their bugs? Plant nasturtiums. Plant them early. If you get them out, well, maybe a little later, right? You plant them out. But get them out and get the trailing types. And what the nasturtium does is it masks the scent of the zucchini or squashes. So when the squash bug comes looking for the squash plant to lay its eggs on, can't find it because the scent is not there because the nasturtiums are there. So it's not repelling them, it's masking what's going on. Another one that does that is little tomato hornworm. Did anyone ever get these guys? Delicious. I think they're one of the bins right now. So the tomato hornworm, it's a moth, it fries and lays an egg. You plant basil all around your tomato plants, especially the Genovese, the big tall basils. That again, it's a fragrance that confuses the moth. They can't find a tomato plant and it just passes it by. Goes to your neighbor's house and we stitch all the flowers over there. Miserate with them. So there are other ecological practices that I want to get into about plant diversity, for example. That's one of the main tenets of ecological gardening is to grow a wide variety of plants, not just growing one or two different kinds of things. And a diverse garden is one that's going to be ecologically healthy. This is our garden a few years ago, and it started out as a vegetable garden. You look at it now, it's hard to find any vegetables. There's flowers here, there's perennial flowers, there's annual flowers, there's vines, there's some shrubs back there, we've got bulbs in here. We've got all kinds of things mixing and matching into that garden. So mixing and matching things like that is like I showed in that original slide, a good way to go. Another thing that horticulturists have learned is you don't want to clean up your perennials in the fall. So the old idea was to go in the fall, cut everything down to the ground, strip it all out, take it all out, go compost it, right? So all keep clean. But that's not ecologically very good for your garden. What ends up happening is you're removing all the beneficial insects, the pollinating insects, all of those are getting removed out of your garden. So now the recommendation is to leave it. People, I tell and say this on my radio shows, are like, thank you. It doesn't work in the fall anymore. And just leave it there all until the spring, until you have a series of 50-degree days, about 4 or 5 days in a row. By then, the beneficial insects and pollinators will have evolved, so they move away. Then you can clean things up if you want to. But even in that situation, what I end up doing is I just chop things down and leave it there as mulch. So I don't have to ever move it anywhere. I'm in doing less work at the garden, as you can see. You want to leave it for hiding places. So not just insects, but snakes, toads, all kinds of other creatures out there that will be working in the garden, keeping it healthy. You want to leave spaces for them to be. You want to attract pollinators and beneficial. You want to have lots of flowers with different kinds of flower heads to them. So these are yarrow with flat heads here. There are different some shaped flowers, like a tropical vine has a tube-shaped flower, or a salvia has a tube-shaped flower. There are daisies that have that kind of radial symmetry, which is when a bee looks at it, it sees it's very balanced, right and left. So these are indications for pollinators that these are plants that they can pollinate, get food from. So having a diversity of those in there will help too. Growing certain plants that are going to attract predator insects that will control the pests in your garden. So if you have aphids, for example, you can plant a Pseudolithium arugula, say you have aphids on your parsley, or you can plant a dill and fennel. There's another one, it has some nice humbles. We let some of our dill and fennel go to seed every year because it attracts a wide variety of beneficial insects to that garden. And it has a beautiful yellow flower, like this, which is kind of floating up above all the foliage of other plants. So to preserve your beneficials, you can also create a beetle bang. A beetle bang attracts this creature. This is a black brown beetle. You'll probably see these if you look in your garden. And these are good guys. These are, I guess you call them carnivores in the insect world, meaning they eat other insects and things. They'll eat aphids, they'll eat caterpillars, sawfly larvae, and they'll eat slugs too. So to attract them, you got to create a habitat that they like. So in the middle of your garden, grow some ornamental grasses. Elevate the soil about 18 inches above the ground. Make about a 3 or 4 foot wide bed from that. And then put in some of the native bunching grasses. Some of the things like blue stem grass, switchgrass, some of those grasses. These ground beetles love those. They hang out in there during the day, and then at night they go into your garden and feed and take care of a lot of the pests. So just being kind of clever about different plants to grow is another way to approach your ecology. And you want to encourage wildlife. How are we doing for food? I'd like you to go. What would you like to do?
Yeah, I guess we could serve ourselves.
Sure. Well, everyone gets settled down and start eating, and then I can continue talking.
Morning. I'll start over there.
I saw your eyes kind of wandering away.
Can we ask questions?
Yes, you can.
What would you preferably do with grass clipping? Mulch with them or throw them out both?
I would do neither. I would just leave them right on the grass.
Really?
So with the mulching mower, you know, when it has a different blade on it, because that'll feed the grass and you won't ever have to fertilize the grass.
I
don't do that,
I keep throwing. what would you mulch with? Not grass clipping.
So if you're not collecting the grass, but you get to get hay straw, now I use that a lot, chopped up leaves, those things work pretty well. Even some scrap type of things you can chop up a little bit, that works as well. It's nice to chop up stuff. You know, run the mower over the leaves, for example, especially if you have thick leaves. That'll break them down a little bit before you put it in your garden or in the bed.
Okay.
Everyone have some food. I'll be back.
No, I'll speak to you. And you do a job with the Brooks. That's one of the better schools.
Waved to everyone. We just had a few questions.
Frank.
Hi. Hey.
Hey. Is Judy?
Judy.
Hey, Judy.
Oh. We'll see if we can get Judy over here.
Okay.
Hey.
Hey, Judy.
Here, I'll bring you over to Judy.
Okay, all right.
Just so you're aware, we're still recording. I could pause it probably.
Oh, boy. I'm on record, Judy. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Frank.
too bad you weren't here.
Well,
how you doing?
best. Thanks. It looks nice. You guys had a nice intro.
What?
I said it looks like you're having a good time.
Yep. Yep. Good meal. Good to see you.
Glad you could make it.
Thanks.
We're almost done with serving everyone, so the meeting okay. will continue just a few moments.
Okay. I'm just going to chill out until we get to the, you know,
okay.
special part.
I think because
okay.
it's part of the meeting, we're going to continue recording. We're still
okay.
in the meeting and haven't adjourned, so I'm just going to leave you guys here to watch the room for a few minutes.
All right. I'll tune out.
All right. Thank you.
Oh, Jim, make sure you get some dinner.
Yeah,
Yeah. How was everything?
Good. Thank you.
I was saying,
Gardening here, and we already have questions coming in online from Frank in Alaska. Ready? That was the Frank in Alaska.
It was actually from Farley Brown.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't have a question.
So I believe Frank's question is about the wool, right? So Frank asked about sheep's wool. If you say you're raising sheep, or you know someone who's raising sheep, and you have a lot of extra wool that they're not going to use, can you use that in the garden? Well, you can't really use it as a soil amendment. It's not going to keep deer or anything away. But what it does do is keep slugs and snails away. So when I was doing one of my garden tours in England, I went to a garden and they mulched a whole garden of hostas with sheep's wool. And what happens is the slugs don't want to go across the sheep's wool because it's all scratchy, got tannins in it. So it keeps them away and the plants look beautiful. So if you're looking for a nice mulch to use, to have the neighbors talking about you. I swear that house got wool all over them, but let's go. Try some sheep's wool. There's another question. Well, let's have a question. Yes.
I wonder if there's a possible of
you've got to get the root system up. That's the key to it. So in your friend, your flower garden, it really is just a matter of going out after already trying to pull out the right way. Then put down some kind of hedging around that garden so it doesn't creeping in from the lawn area. You can get metal hedging that goes down pretty deep, or you can use anything plastic hedging that goes down. And that'll kind of stop it from creeping back here. But short of that, you can keep mowing it, but then.
What about a line of order to put down?
Yeah, you want to do some kind of border area?
Wider border?
Well, I think one time you need the mulch too. Yeah, so that's why I think we need to get you.
Okay.
We can go down a foot deep because that was getting my deal.
Okay,
let's continue with wildlife in the ecological garden. So, an ecological garden is going to have a diversity of wildlife, some good, some not so good. You know, those four legged things with the ears? The deer. So let's talk about some of the different things you could do. There's a guy, an entomologist from University of Delaware named Deb Tallamy. You ever hear of him? No. Okay. He wrote a couple of books, Bringing Nature Home and Nature's Bed. Oh, there's Doug right there. Book. And he was curious about native plants, and about native plants and wildlife, particularly about birds. And what he wanted to find out was that which plants in the forest going to have the most diversity of insects in them that birds can use to feed their babies. So being a professor, he took it, said all of his grad students out in the forest, and one summer they had to count the different species of caterpillars that they found in the forest.
That's a nice job. Well, you're right.
And what he found was that there are certain native species that are keystone species, ones you really need to have a healthy ecosystem. And 5% of the native species of plants that are in the forest support 75% of the pollinators that you have. So having these key species is really important. If you want to ever find out which the species are where you are in this area out here in Northeast Kingdom, you can go to the National Wildlife Federation's Keystone Native Plant Guide. That's the URL out there. And you put in your zip code and it'll upload plants. The plants will pop up. Perennials, the trees, and the shrubs. Now, he looked at it in terms of woody plants. So he wanted to find out what plant and how many different species of butterfly and moth larvae were in those plants. So which species of woody plant or tree, a tree would be the one that has the most amount of species of butterfly and moth larvae. Which one? Give me a guess.
Fruit tree.
Yep.
Oak
tree. Oak trees have 534 different species, but then it's black cherry, willow, birch, poplar, and crab apple. Now, we'll speak down the list. So if you have these trees in your landscape, you want to keep these trees. If you're thinking of planting large trees in your landscape, you should try to plant a couple of these trees because they're hosting the food for those birds to actually fledge their nests. A little songbird with a little clutch of eggs in there. Takes, I don't know how many weeks, 6 weeks, 3 weeks, or something like that, to actually hatch them and have them fledge. How many caterpillars do you think that those, that nest will need to feed those little babies?
Six thousand
caterpillars.
Wow.
So you want to have trees that have a caterpillar for those little birds to survive. Now, when you compare the native plants like these with the exotic plants, like a ginkgo, a street tree that you often see in cities, two species. And so there's another reason for growing native plants, that they're gonna house a lot of these different types of insects that are important. Other things that birds are gonna need and insects are need are nesting sites. When a tree blows over in the forest, did anyone hear it? Different question. If a tree blows over in the forest, you should leave it there. Now, this is one that blew over on our septic mound, so we had to actually cut it to get it off the septic mound. But we left the logs there. What happens as it decomposes is it has lots of insects, which is food, and it can be nesting sites for different kinds of creatures that are there. Don't want to do what my neighbor did. I love him, Lori. He's a great guy, and he's really into gardening, but he likes a nice clean forest. So he goes in and cuts out everything underneath the forest and even rakes out some of the leaves sometimes, which of course is the worst thing you can do in a forest. You want to have a lot of different species and you want to have a lot of different age growth going on in your forest. Leave things in the forest, leave it messy. It's important to be that way for the ecological side of things. Leave snag trees, unless it's going to fall in your house. But otherwise, if you have a snag tree on your property, leave it there. It's a nesting site for birds. Got all kinds of insects in there that feed a lot of different creatures. They need a water supply. So if you have a tree that has a hollow heartwood center and it fills up with water, it's a perfect little bird bath. Or you can put bird baths up. That's another way to make sure the birds have enough water. You can even create mud puddles in your perennial flower garden. So if you have a clay soil, anyone have clay soil here?
Yeah,
okay. Dig out a little hole, that clay soil, and just put some water in it, but don't worry about keeping it filled up with water. Just make sure it's moist. On a hot summer day, like the ones we're going to be having the next few days or so, you're going to see butterflies, you're going to see bees, they're all going to be flocking there to get the water. If it's clay soil, they get minerals too that they need to stay healthy. So a very simple thing to do is just create a mud puddle right in your garden, and that's going to help you. Big brush piles, you know, they make brush piles. A lot of people, of course, will burn them or drag them off and get rid of them. Leave them there because they're habitat for everything from a rabbit. You have a rabbit, and you need to have a bobcat, and have a fox. You're going to have hawks, you're going to have owls, you have all these predators coming in. And the birds who are going out and get some food and coming back. So leave areas in there that are messy and a little brush pile. And of course, avoid pesticides if you can. The more you can avoid that, so including organic pesticides too, the better your habitat will be. So let's talk about native plants and exotic plants and invasive plants here to wrap up the chatting topics. This is a cornelian cherry. Anyone ever grow a cornelian cherry? It's a kind of dogwood. Beautiful spring flowering tree. You see how early it flowered. There's nothing else flowering around it. It's got these little yellow flowers that the bees really like. Nice one to have. So what is a native plant? There's lots of definitions for native plants. You want to get into an argument with someone in the gardening world, start telling them about what native plants are and what they're not. Chances are they have a whole different idea. Is it something that was here 10,000 years ago, like horsetail? Horsetail is? Yeah. If you haven't, you know what it is. That was here when the dinosaurs were here. Is it something that was here when the European settlers came? Has it been something that's been here in the 21st century? Well, how do you define a native plant? How I like to define it is it's a plant that naturally occurs in the place where it evolved. So it might have been there a long time or not, but it's naturally occurring somewhere, and it's evolved in such a way that it's playing nice with others. It's not overrunning the landscape. It has relationships with the insects, with the birds, with all the kinds of things that are there. So some of these terms that you'll see about natives and non-natives, naturalized, I think it's just a plant that's been there a long time and has adapted. It may originally not been here, but now has really adapted. Invasive ones, you know those. A lot of those are exotic. And the native are these new species of plants that are bred so that they have all the characteristics of a true native plant, but they also look nice. It's more attractive than anything. So native plants are important because they're adapted to the environment over time. They're low maintenance, they conserve water, and they reduce climate change because they stay in the landscape a long time. They stay a lot in the landscape. And they're better food for wildlife. There was a study done in Maine, which was looking at the berries from an exotic shrub, say an invasive exotic, like Japanese honeysuckle, or buckthorn is another one. Versus one that's from a native shrub, like a gray dogwood. And what they found when they analyzed the berries' nutritional content is that the calorie content was the same. But when they looked at the fat content, the native berry had 46% fat, whereas the exotic invasive berry had 2% fat. So if you're a little bird trying to make it through the winter here, like a chickadee, or one that's going to migrate south in the winter, you want to have a lot of fat. So that's one of the reasons why it's important to have native plants in the landscape. And they're beautiful. Some examples here. It's a quick quiz. All right. Anyone know these plants? You know what this one is? The part, the shady spot in the forest. Tiarella. Anyone ever hear of Tiarella? Right. How about this one? Bee balm.
That's right.
How about here?
Aster.
Aster. All right. It's butterfly is on something that's called a butterfly weed. It's lefty. So these are all native plants. Some trees and shrubs. We'll try again.
Cherries.
What's that?
Cherry.
Amelanchier.
Service berry.
Great question. This is a
bush cranberry.
Yes, very good. Who is that guy? Put a ringer in the audience. How about this one down here?
A little hard to see.
Elderberry. Blackberries, black fruit on it.
He said the,
who said it?
Elderberry?
Nope. Well, so aronium. Chokeberry. And this one, you don't really see the fruit on it, but you see the fall color of it.
Right.
That's a blueberry. Look how nice it looks in the fall, right? Instead of growing those burning bushes, so how do you choose the right plant for your garden? There are lists, state, regional, native plant lists. Go into the forest, go wherever this plant is growing, see what it likes, be investigated, be curious. Go see where the Amelanchier or the Juniperus berry is growing. Often you'll find it maybe on the edge of the forest, so what kind of soil it has. Create those same conditions in your yard or find those places where the conditions can be same. And that's going to be a good place to have it. And you want to choose the right species. For example, milkweed. Does anyone have some pastures and milkweed have gotten to? It's not a fun thing. It'll spread. Common milkweed spreads all over. So a lot of people want to grow milkweed in their little gardens to get the monarch butterflies to come. It's a nice idea, but the milkweed eventually can take over their whole garden and their whole yard. So getting the right species of milkweed and not base it like that is really important. Also, some of the plants that are native don't play nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Raspberries, goldenrod, these plants can come in as a succession crop and really take over environment for a while before they get shaded out by other plants. Invasives are a problem because they create a monoculture and reduce the number of species in the area. They're hard to control, they have no natural predators. And they're not great as a food, like I was saying about those different berries from native and exotic plants. Not all natives are harmless. So, it's a native plant. What is it? Scratch, scratch, scratch. Poison ivy. Yes, exactly. Leaves are free. Let them be. Mm-hmm. This is a native plant. This is a great native plant. It produces berries that birds love. It often will grow on the edge of a forest and buffer the wind so that the thunderstorm or a real strong hurricane or something's coming through, it's going to buffer the wind going through the forest so trees don't blow over as easily. So if you have this on your property and it's not somewhere where you're walking or you're interacting with it, leave it. Just leave the book. It's actually a good plant to have. If you do have it, I'll show you in a minute or two how to control it. What's this other one right over here? Horse tail, yeah. It's been around since the dinosaurs. Longer than people. Yeah. Sure. And it's a native plant, but it certainly can take over, especially a wet area. Loves wet soil. And not all non-natives are bad. You know what this one is? They're trying to be meadows all the time.
Yara?
Close.
Dansley?
Dansley. Very good. Yeah. That's one that's native to Europe, but it's been here, it's naturalized, and now it's a great pollinator plant because a lot of bees and insects love it. This one over here, do you know what this one is? It'll be often in areas that are going to be over and it comes in. Big stalk. Mullein, yes. Mullein, another one. A nice succession plant. One of the first ones to come in in a certain area to get the soil ready. But before we go into all the different natives and invasives, I always want to ask the question, who really is in the invasive species here? What species has caused more changes to this planet than anything else? Yeah, right here. Me personally, I've been doing this for a long time. So any way that you can grow things differently in your yard, live a little bit differently, and your lifestyle less impactful on the planet, it's going to be more important than what tree or shrub you actually grow. Hey, moving on. Let's kill some invasives.
All right.
Poison ivy. So, if you have poison ivy like growing up, like I was saying, you want to leave it in there. But if you have to get rid of it, first of all, make sure you're not allergic to poison ivy. I know people who've just gone head first into it, not even checking, and then they get end up in the emergency room. So, also, you want to use gloves, long sleeve shirts, and pants, and boots. Hats, mat, everything. You want to just cover your whole body with some kind of covering because the oil that's in there can actually stay in clothing and boots on the tools for months and months and months. You get poison ivy from touching your hands for 6 months later. So make sure you're protecting yourself that before you hit. And digging it out. That's probably the best way to get rid of it is to try to dig it out as much as you possibly can. Where it is as a young plant, a lot of times it gets confused with Virginia creeper. And the difference between the two is that poison ivy has 3 leaflet leaves. Virginia creeper has 5 leaflet leaves. Virginia creeper is another native plant all over the place. Oriental bittersweet. Anyone have any of these in their landscape? No. This is a vine that will just kind of take over a whole area. You can tell it's an oriental bittersweet because of the way the little seed pods are. They're yellow and they open up for red. The American bitter speech is not invasive, as the good plant can have, as orange seed pods that are clustered at the end of the stem, not all along the stem like this. So knowing what you're dealing with, making sure you're getting rid of the right plant is really kind of an important thing. Japanese honeysuckle is one of the first shrubs to flower in the spring, and pretty soon it'll be producing red berries that, again, the birds really love, but not very nutritionally dense for them at all. Buckthorn, another invasive, with those blackberries. These plants spread because the birds eat the berries, fly off, and keep them out, feed them. That's how they spread all over the place. So becoming a true invasive. And burning bushes, which are now illegal in the state of Vermont. You're not able to buy a burning bush. If you have one in your landscape, chop it down and get yourself a cougar. Beautiful shrubs in the landscape, they have a beautiful red foliage color in the fall. Japanese knotweed. Someone came up to me earlier and asked about Japanese knotweed. Oh, yeah. Japanese knotweed is really the almost impossible weed to get rid of. Because of the way it grows. Not because it flowers, it's because of the stems and the root system. So if you break off the stem, you leave it on the ground, it's going to root.
Yeah.
If the roots are not totally removed from the soil, they're going to shoot up new shoots. There's been a study that was done. And they cleaned up an area of all the Japanese knotweed. They put a tarp down in the area and left it there for 20 years. They pulled the tarp off, and guess what happened the next year? It popped up. So don't feel bad if you can't get rid of it. If you contain it, you'll minimize how much it's spreading. That's probably the best thing to do.
How do you do this?
How? How do we do that?
Yeah.
So let me go through that in a minute.
Okay.
About that. Controlling your bases, we'll go right into the element. Yes.
What about the sumac?
Sumac can spread around, you know, the regular staghorn sumacs. And if you just keep cutting them down and keep mowing them down, you'll eventually exhaust them. They're actually a kind of a good plant because all the seeds and those flower inflorescences have seeds in them for the birds. So if you have it in an area of your yard where you just let it go, that's fine. But if it's creeping in somewhere, just keep mowing it down. If you keep mowing, it'll give you a way to keep down. So you need a combination of diligence. Good question. Repeat mowing an area 2 to 3 times. 2 to 3 times, 2 to 3 weeks through the summer. Every 2 to 3 weeks in the summer is a good way to kind of exhaust the food system. Even if you're not going to kill it that way, you're going to weaken it. So that when you come through and you cover it over with a tarp, that's going to weaken it even further. Make sure you put that tarp beyond where the weed cap to. Anyone have a question? Weed? Take a podium? Driving up here, I saw someone had it around an old tree. It was beautiful. It was in flower. And then I realized, oh, that's all fissure. The way they're controlling it, they're mowing around and just leaving it there. There's nothing else in there. But So make sure you go beyond where the fissure weed is or any of those invasives because it has root systems that'll spread. And they got weed plants in a small pan. So after you've done all of this, then go back in and dig out the plant and get as much of the root system as you can. Then after that, you have to do the same digging out of the plant every year for a number of years. Decade. Millennium. It takes a while because any of these roots, a lot of the plants can stay in the soil and will become a new plant. But the roots, when they're small, they're not going to have a very vigorous plant. Usually you pull them out. And if you have to, you can use an herbicide on it. A foliar foam or infection herbicide is the safest one to use because you can put it right into where the plant is. So repeat cutting, whether it be mowing it down with mowers, mowing it down with brush hogs, string trimming it down, bringing in the neighbor's goats. There's another thing that some people use goats. They might have to clean up some of these weedy patches. When you're digging it out, often you'll see when you go to a forest, like a conservation area, I used to see these shrubs that have been pulled out of the ground, turned upside down, and they're hanging in the trees. I thought it was some kind of curse or something.
Don't go beyond the spot.
And what it is that you don't want to just dig out an invasive and leave it on the ground or make a pile out of it because it's just going to root again. So that's why they hang them upside down on trees so they make sure they really die. So digging things out after a rain is the best time to do it. And if you have to use herbicides, use a foam or an injection. So this is a buckthorn here, and it can cut off to the ground level, and you can see you're using a foam right on the top of it. That'll get translocated down into the woods and kill it. I would also cover this with something like a little yogurt container or something, so that no insects or wildlife can hit it off. If you get injured. The same thing you can do with an injector. And this is an injection herbicide going into a Japanese knotweed stem. So that would be one of the things you can do. Injecting. The problem with Japanese knotweed is it tends to grow near streams and waterways. And you should not be using herbicides along streams and waterways because it's toxic for the amphibians and the fish.
This is my backyard.
What's that?
In a dry area.
It's a dry area. Yeah. So you could do this. So I would mow it down repeatedly and then maybe inject some herbicide into it and probably will kill it. It won't kill it completely, but it'll actually knock it down enough so that you can dig it out or you can stay on top of it after that. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the step process of controlling a lot of the invasives. The last thing I want to talk to you about, and you have strawberry shortcake in is invasive plant substitute. Once you clean out the invasive, don't just pack it over and back, go have a beer. You got to put something in there that's going to take that place in the ecosystem. So what are you going to substitute for it? It's not invasive. So yellow flag irises are invasive, but blue flag irises are not. So if you're pulling out the yellow flag, put it in a little blue green. Purple loosestrife. Anyone have purple loosestrife?
Right?
And once you remove that, once you get it out of there, the swamp milkweed, this is one of those milkweed species that does well in wet areas and is not as aggressive spreading as the common milkweed that's out there. Common reedgrass, Phragmites, you see this in different on the interstate, 91, 89, goes up towards North Canada.
Phragmites,
exactly. This is one, and once you can get it out, then you can put in some of the switchgrasses or the native grasses that will take that place in that ecosystem. Garlic mustard. I've seen this in the forest, especially in open area in the forest, spreads all over the place. This is that plant tiarella I showed you earlier, not flowering. Looks a lot like the garlic mustard. It's a native shade-loving forest plant. It's a nice one to instead. Japanese barberries, dwarf ninebark. Ninebark is a nice native plant with beautiful dark colored leaves, beautiful pink flowers, and then the flowers turn into these little seed pods that are kind of red. So it gives you that impression of a barberry, but it's not as invasive. Japanese honeysuckle that I talked about, great dogwoods, are really great. I have these on our property, and every, say, August, September, they're loaded with these white berries, and then after a couple of weeks, they're all gone. Birds are eating off, and we love them so much. Much nicer. It's a pretty aggressive plant, but it's not as invasive as a Japanese honeysuckle. I already talked about burning bushes and blueberries, right? Plant blueberries, yeah. Wisteria, not sure you grow wisteria up there, but you try to grow the Asian wisteria, it's pretty invasive. But there's an American and a Kentucky wisteria. It's hardier and it's not invasive. That would be better in the landscape. Norway maples. I once owned a house that must have been built in the early 1970s when they were planting a lot of Norway maples because we had one of these crimson colored, the Norway maples. And every spring, it had like hundreds of little babies coming up all around underneath. So if you have Norway maples and you try to do something different, you have the look of that, you can use the purple leaf peach. There are hardy versions of that, and certainly the crab, the purple leaf crab apples like very kind. So all of this, from the soil to the vegetables to the companion plants, to the different practices you can do, and to the beneficial insects and native plants, is all to create a healthy ecological landscape that's going to look nice, be productive, and be less work for you. And now you can have your strawberry shortcake. Do you have questions now or you want to eat first?
I have a question.
Okay. Yes, sir.
What do you do with your bamboo? Oh, bamboo.
Well, the Japanese knotweed is often called bamboo because it has a hollow stem. Yeah. That's the one where you have to, cut it down. And if you're not near a waterway, you can put an injected herbicide into it to kill it down.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Last summer, I had a lilac bush that developed its light, a black light, and even it all fell off. Well, in October, it warmed up enough to rebud it, but then it had a hard freeze. So half of it didn't come back.
And what happened this spring?
A lot of it didn't come back.
Yeah.
So that it's gone.
Well, as long as it has some new growth in it.
It did.
Do you have any suckers coming up in the base?
Some, yeah.
Yeah. So I would get your chainsaw. Is there a big lilac?
Well, handsaw or chainsaw. And I would just cut it down really low. Down to low. Yeah, let the new growth come up. It'll take a few years for the flower, but it'll be much more big.
Weird how we budded in October right around Halloween because we had that warm spell.
Right,
here,
right.
And then we had a hard freeze here and it just.
Yeah, down where I live, they often take flower in October. I would drive around Madison County, Chittenden County, and to see all these lilacs in flower because it was cold, and then it warmed up. And they thought winter happened, and that's true. But of course, that means you have less flowers in the spring.
Right. So this is
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Garlic lesbian, you can hoe it down. A little spirit in the forest, the rose is replaced with a rough fob in there. And you can dig it out. That's probably the best thing to do. And once you get it out, put it in the peel out. And that is what makes happen.
Yes.
Poison hemlock.
Yeah.
all over the place.
Yeah,
it's hard to contain.
Yeah, in a wet area or just all over. Yeah, I think again, if you can keep mowing it down and trying to keep it back away from where you're interacting with it, that way you won't get the punch pad or any of that stuff. Yeah, that's probably the best thing.
If you come up with a plan for the state of Vermont to control the wild parsnip,
let me think, huh? I think every high school senior should go out 3 days of the year, full parsnip. It's a hard one because, as you know, it drops seed all over the place. You can mow it down and it comes right back up again. So,
it started down south and they were down there bush hogging, mowing the roads and coming north and deposit the seed
as they go. Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah.
So it spreads around. Yeah, the best thing to do is repeated mowing or to try to pull it out. It pulls out pretty easily if the soil is wet. It's got a tap root because it's in that parsnip family, and it pulls out pretty easily. But short of that, and doing all of that before it sets seed, that's probably the critical thing. Even if you can't pull it out,
you want to dress and lay that from head to toe when they're handling them.
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure. I made the mistake of doing it with shorts on once, and I had all these blisters around my ankles from, just having the chemical on it, sun. So I think the key with that one, because it self-sows so readily, is if you can't pull it out, at least mow it down before it starts setting seeds. There is an insect that attacks it. I see it sometimes when I'm traveling around. You see the whole clusters has an insect like a caterpillar. So I'm not sure if that's something that's natural or introduced or whatever. So maybe that will keep going. What happens a lot of times, the insects will start reproducing because there's a lot of food. And so we'll start controlling. Anything else? All right. Well, listen.
Is there a migration time for the monarch?
A migration time?
We have to pay that for a couple of years.
Oh, well, it kind of depends on where you are and what's going on as far as where they show up. But usually by now you should start pretty soon. What's this, June? Yeah, July. You should start seeing them. The more milkweed that's around, that's their favorite food. The more they're likely to come around.
Yeah, we keep growing.
You keep growing it. Hoping for monarchs. Thank you all very much. There are some books here if you're interested.
We're just about done.
It's not done yet.
Huh?
Not done yet.
What?
Dinner's ready.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Bob has been elected for a first term. Michael Strait, for Essex County, Michael Strait has been appointed for a first term, as well as Gary Briggs for a first term. And for Orleans, Farley Brown was appointed for a second term.
Thank you, Judy. Thank you, Charlie.
Having none, motion to adjourn.
Second.
Thank you very much. Enjoy. Nice dinner. Good evening.
I said you make a motion that I do get trouble to take my hand off.
Jim Davis.
Jim Davis, perfect. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Have a good evening.